How shall we study our Old Testaments? This is part one. We'll be in this for a while. Certain characters are transitional characters. They have accounts in Scripture leading up to them and then the results of their lives unfolding after them. I'm going to be looking a little bit tonight at Joshua. He plays such a pivotal role. He's one of those characters in Israel's history because after all of their wanderings and struggles, he's the one who will actually lead them into the promised land. So he transitions a new epic, a new phase in Israel's walk with the Lord. Israel enjoyed its greatest military success under Joshua. He's really the key link between the Pentateuch and the rest of the scriptures in the Old Testament. You get to see much of the Old Testament fulfilled in the life and ministry of Joshua. And I thought maybe a good place to start this would be, why did God choose Joshua for this job? I mean, what made him so usable to the Lord? I think it's more than an academic question or a theological question. What is God looking for today in the lives of people who will make a difference for him tomorrow in their circumstances, in their workplaces, in their educational places? It seems to take more than luck to make life work on God's terms. So what is the key for people? I assume we want this. What is the key for people who want to accomplish things for God, who want to do more than just get by, get to heaven maybe when they die, but have an impact, a ministry, change things for the kingdom and glory of God? That's really what these books, sandwiched in the middle of the Old Testament, are all about. You have these great leaders, and there are also terrible flops. It's really a confusing thing to go through and see the kings that come. You got a godly king, a godly father. His son rules. He's terrible, wicked, idolatrous, ungodly. He has a son. The son comes into power. He's a godly king. You see these ups and downs and ups and downs. Joshua just seems so steady. What does the Bible teach about the making of a godly leader? The godly leader in your home, teachers, parents, children's workers, business people. People just who want to make a difference in their Christian walk, who want to transform others just by their path in life. What does the Bible teach about having an influence for God? That's what we want. You realize when you start to study it that Joshua didn't just materialize in the first chapter of the book bearing his name. So if you want to take the time to look, you'll see an extensive schooling, preparing of this great leader. So before we launch further into Joshua and other books in the Old Testament, I want to take a few weeks just examining the calling of Joshua, the shaping of Joshua, the would-be leader. And it starts long before Joshua chapter 1. There are some, I think, really important background texts where things are learned in Joshua's life that shaped his ministry down the road. These are the texts with the life lessons that Joshua seems to have needed and seems to have remembered. I'm going to go over two of them tonight and one of them next Sunday night. Here's the first thing Joshua learns, though not in the book bearing his name, before that. Lesson number one, power comes from the Lord. But you have to go back to Exodus chapter 17, 8 to 16, and you'll read this account. It's a fascinating one. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, there he is. This, by the way, is the first mention of Joshua in the Old Testament, right here. Moses said to Joshua, choose for us men, go out, fight with Amalek. Moses continues, tomorrow I'll stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. Remember that, staff of God? So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek. Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up on top of the hill. So they're in the valley. These three are up on the hill. They're looking down. They see what's going on. 11. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. Here's the problem. Moses is not a young man. Moses' hands grew weary. And so they took a stone, put it under him. He sat on the stone. Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side, one on the other side. So these two guys have Moses' arms, and they're holding him up in the air. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. This is all day. And Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Okay, so there's the event. We know that we're meant to study this. We're meant to learn from this. And here's how you know. 14, then the Lord said to Moses. Now God talks to Moses. The battle's over. Write this. That's what you've got in Exodus. Moses was obedient. Write this as a memorial in the book. Look, and recite it in the ears of Joshua. Write this down and make sure Joshua gets the message. That I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying, quote, a hand upon the throne of the Lord. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. So the lesson, power comes from the Lord, Joshua. The externals of the story, they're not that complicated. They're pretty easy to memorize. Kids would get it in Sunday school lessons. When I was a kid, you had neat things like flannel graph boards, and you'd stick little paper things on. You could get the whole story. And you'd see this story, and it was a fascinating story. Israel's at war with the Amalekites. God isn't just picking on the Amalekites. They've been idolatrous, wicked, rebelling against God's people. God's going to judge them. Joshua is the new young field commander of the troops. This is, I said, the very first mention of Joshua in the scriptures. He's a young man. And he's thrust into the middle of this pretty crucial situation. Moses just says, go down into the valley and fight the Amalekites. Okay. The text says the Amalekites are set against God. That's that Exodus 17, 15, and 16. Moses built an altar and called the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying, quote, a hand upon the throne of the Lord. That's the Amalekites. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. The Amalekites have set their hands on the throne, the rule, the authority of God himself through their false, idolatrous religion, through their pride, through their violence. They're trying to usurp God's rightful place of rule. They were zealous and passionate. They were angry and arrogant. Now we start to see something important about young Joshua. He's not that experienced, but he's observant. That's a great trait in Joshua. You'll see it over and over. Nothing is wasted on him. He looks and sees the meaning of things. He interprets things. Life doesn't just happen to him, even though he's young. He learns to notice what's really behind outward events. He learns about God. And here's what he learned. Here's what he learns right away. A, Joshua learns really quickly. Maybe that's why Moses sends him down, the Amalekites. Joshua learns that God will not be rebelled against without consequence. That's still true, by the way. We need to be careful that in the rightful emphasis on his mercy, his grace, his love, his faithfulness, all those wonderful things, all you have to do is start reading your Bible and you don't fool with God. He's not a tame God. Joshua learns God will not be rebelled against without consequence. These Amalekites are numerous and mighty. They've been settled into a pattern of ignoring God, rebelling against God for a long time, seemingly without any consequence. But their time has come. It's absolutely certain, even though they can't imagine it's coming. This is the important lesson poking Joshua in the face. There is not one earthly reason for the Amalekites to lose this battle with Israel. They're more numerous, they're more mighty, they're more powerful. By far, they're the dominant power. No reason for them to lose except one. You can't persistently rebel against God without consequence. That is still true, by the way. You can't persistently rebel against God without consequence. God will have Joshua down in the battlefield for a reason. Enemies will fall by his own hand. This wasn't the kind of warfare you fight like you see on TV where it's missiles and bombs and missiles and bombs and nobody's one-on-one with anybody. That wasn't what was going on here. No one will see like Joshua will see what happens when people rebel against the hand of God. Joshua learns at square one that the only wise response to God is an obedient response, a humble response, a submissive response. That's the first lesson he learns. There's another lesson that's maybe even more basic. B, Israel's true source of power isn't in army or sword. Power comes from the Lord. That's what verse 11 is all about. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, he got tired, Amalek prevailed. Try and catch a feel for this. Joshua is down there. It's the kind of battle, shield, sword, spear, hack. And they're doing well and they're winning. Wait a minute. Moses' hands, they're coming down. And all of a sudden, Joshua sees things happening. His own soldiers, his own men die, 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 die. Moses' hands, they prop them up. All of a sudden, they take the battle to the enemy. They're victorious. And Joshua starts to catch on. Wait a minute. There's a connection here. Moses' arms may get tired, but that's not his only loss. When Moses' hands come down, Joshua starts to see his soldiers fall. Blood flows. The pain of powerlessness hits home with the lowering of Moses' intercessory prayer hands. And the vivid consequences hit Joshua firsthand. I'm sure he never forgot it. Now, what's the point? Nothing I say in this teaching tonight is as important as this point. What Joshua sees in the bleeding, broken rubble of human lives from the cooling of prayer is only what always happens when people don't pray made visible. Did I make that clear? What Joshua sees as Moses' intercessory prayer hands come down, what he sees is only what always happens when prayer dies, made visible. There are consequences. Things matter. In that sense, the passage holds this eternal principle. There really is a message here for any church, our church. This passage is God's way of teaching Joshua something we all need reminding of. If you want to see what happens when people forget to pray, when people go weary in prayer, when they take prayer for granted or are inclined to give up or just get so busy with the battles of life or the running of programs that they forget to wait on the Lord, watch Joshua. It's not enough for God just to tell Joshua how important prayer is. Truth told only reaches us on a certain level. It's like listening to a Bible study on a Sunday night. Truth heard is good. Truth demonstrated is best. It's more unforgettable. In Joshua's battle, God very firmly put this lesson in visible terms. At least this time, Joshua is allowed to see that all the soldiers, chariots, swords, and spears won't win the battle if Moses' prayer hands come down. Isn't that a good lesson? Picture it. This staff, this rod of Moses, it comes down, and the Israeli bodies start to fall. Joshua looks up to the mountain, very quickly puts two and two together. God is the source of their power. God is the source of their victory. And nothing else will work in the battle without those prayer hands. I don't know. I don't even like the kind of searching questions that begs. What happens when church prayer rooms and altars empty just because some cool-hearted Christians who come to church want it to be more user-friendly? Let me just tell you a secret. Been here 43 and a half years. There are very, very few Sundays where someone doesn't come up to me Sunday morning and say, "I used to come Sunday night," or "I'd come Sunday night." You do those, and they'll say something like this. "You do those prayer groups." "I hate doing those prayer groups." They'll say something like that. And I get it. I can remember. I was in Jack Hayford's church the very first time I was in a prayer group, and I thought it was the weirdest thing I'd ever seen. Now, when I hear that, you try and be gracious. You know, we try not to embarrass you. Come, just join a group. You don't have to pray. You always try and say the right thing, but there never is the right thing to say. The issue is, what happens when people stop praying? Anything? This story. What happens? What starts to happen? And you realize there's a lot at stake. It's a big deal. What begins to rot and decompose under the surface of our lives long before the collapse appears on the outside? What happens in a home where parents don't pray with their kids, when personal devotions get scarce, when people just get so busy finding time for certain things in a hectic life that they just don't have time to pray? And when all those questions emerge, remember Exodus 17. God says, "Put Moses up on the mountain, put Joshua on the valley, let the two figure out how important prayer is. I'll show them." Two. Took a little while with that, sorry. Joshua learns to live all of life in the presence of God. I'll go quick. Exodus 24, 9 to 18. "Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel." This is right after the giving of the Ten Commandments. They're going over it. "There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven of clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. The Lord said to Moses, 'Come up to me on the mountain and wait there, that I may give you the tablets of stone.'" It's going to be recorded now what he said. "With the law and the commandment that I have written for their instruction." So Moses rose with his assistant, Joshua. See, Joshua. Moses rose with his assistant Joshua. Moses went up the mountain of God, said to the elders, wait here for us until we return to you. Behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute, let them go to them. Then Moses went up the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain, and the glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. Moses entered the cloud, went up on the mountain. Moses is on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Joshua didn't just learn that God is always omnipresent. This wasn't theology. Joshua learned on the mountain with Moses. For the very first time, Joshua got to go with Moses into the presence of God, and he sees. This is important. He sees what Moses sees. In other words, Joshua, this young leader, he gets to see the glory of God in a way that he won't see it again. He sees the glory that is almost always invisible. Why? Why is it important this once for Moses to see the glory of God made visible? Well, I'll tell you why. He's going to have the job of leading these millions of people. And he's not always going to see God like he sees him on this occasion with Moses. In the future, in the same way, he won't see prayer warriors with their hands raised in battle while he fights, but he'll remember the lesson. In the same way, many of Joshua's days are going to be like yours, and they're going to be like mine, pretty ordinary days, filled with all sorts of people problems and squabbles. You try keeping about a million people happy and cheerful as they wander through the wilderness. There'll be administrative details. You've got all sorts of things in your life, tax forms, visa bills, leaky pipes, you name it. Most of the days, God seems removed from the ordinary events that Joshua sees. And most of the time, you don't see him. He's removed from what you can see in your daily events as well. But if he's going to lead the people, Joshua is going to always have to remember not to just get bogged down in secular and administrative. He must never let his problems block out that one time when the great unseen God, who truly is there, made himself visible to Joshua. And the reason, it's the same as the first lesson, prayer. Even though he won't always see Moses with his hands raised, prayer, power belongs to the Lord. Now, living life in the presence of God, the ordinary days when he doesn't see it. Hebrews 11:1 calls this the conviction of things not seen. So faith for Joshua, he learns this lesson. Faith operates under the conviction that there's always more going on than we see with these physical eyes. That's why Paul prays that the eyes of the heart, you have these eyes and you have these eyes. And Paul prays that the eyes of your heart would be open to see and know. There's more going on in small choices. There's more going on in small compromises. The presence of God is there. So just this one time, God tells Moses, bring Joshua up on the mountain. Just this time, bring Joshua, I'm going to reveal my glory, and I want him to remember it all the time, because the same glory is with him when he doesn't see it like he's going to see it this time. God's going to show Joshua his glory so he'll never doubt it again. But that'll become a foundation so that he will start to always take God as seriously even when he doesn't see his glory like he did this one time. We have the record in the text. You can see God's glory. You might not see it when you're at school tomorrow and university tomorrow. You don't see it the same way. But remember it. Remember it. Live in the light of it. There's a third lesson in the preparation of Joshua. It's 6 o'clock. We'll look at that next Sunday night.